All right. Well, that was my a kind of introduction, because because now the question is, all right. So what about today? We all know what's been going on for many years now in the southern part of the country, with missiles being fired from Gaza against all kinds of targets as far as they can reach, basically. And we all know that not just one government, but several governments for years now have failed to do anything of any great value or significance in order to put a stop to this, correct? There's no doubt that one of the reasons that successive Israeli governments refuse to do this is because they fear that if they order a ground offensive in Gaza, there will be many casualties on our side. They're also worried, by the way, although they should not be, but they are, about casualties on the other side. But they're certainly also worried, even more probably, I'm willing to imagine and suppose, about many casualties on our side. And there's no question that would be the case. If you send ground troops into Gaza, there's no question that many will be killed. Unless you expect outright miracles completely above and beyond the normal way of the world. And en somchim al hanes, as we know. So you can't rely on such things. So that would be the likely outcome. Militarily, therefore, what is the solution? Well, one is not allowed to say this in the present constellation in Israeli society. But the solution actually is very simple. You don't have to send a single soldier into Gaza to put an end to that. All you need to do is to give the order for massive bombardments from the air, and maybe even without that, it's even cheaper by artillery. Massive artillery barrages against all parts of Gaza for every single missile that comes our way, and you will discover very, very quickly, I'm sure, that they will start firing missiles, because if for every missile we destroy an entire neighborhood in Gaza and 10,000 people die in Gaza, not here, then you will very quickly discover they haven't got 10,000 people to spare if for every missile they fire, and they will quickly learn the lesson. They haven't got endless resources, endless people, endless neighborhoods. They just haven't. And we're not dealing with China, who have, you know, 500,000 people spare, and they can afford it, or they don't mind, or something. And maybe they do mind anyhow. I don't know. I haven't asked the Chinese, but thank God for the meantime, the Chinese are not firing missiles at us. But the Arabs in Gaza are, and if they were to get that kind of response, it would be all over very, very quickly. So why aren't we doing it? The answer is, we're told, is that it's immoral, it's improper. Jews, this is not the Jewish way, this is not according to Jewish ethics. So we are told by such great luminaries and experts in Jewish tradition and halakha and law, like Professor Yuli Tamir and Aharon Barak and Yossi Beilin, etc. People obviously who are steeped in the a thorough knowledge of Judaism in all its aspects. So what is one to make of such an argument? Well, I'm sure, as you understand, such an argument that these people present is completely spurious according to the Torah, and by the way, also according to common sense. Even if without the Torah, common sense dictates that this is what you do and this is what you must do in order to put an end to such a situation. What does anyone here think the United States would do if missiles were to start raining down on California from Mexico? I think we all know what they would do, and they also might choose not to send a single infantry soldier into Mexico. Cruise missiles and artillery pieces would start firing on the American side of the border and send a very powerful message that you don't mess with us because it's not worth your while. That's what would happen, I'm sure, and everyone would think that would be perfectly okay and perfectly normal. The fact is, maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the world wouldn't have thought it would have been normal, by the way, even if we did it. But as things stand at the present moment, I think that even in the world as it is today, as anti-Israel, as anti-Semitic, as completely corrupt as it is, the situation is so glaringly irrational and impossible that even the world wouldn't be able to really say anything or do anything if we were to respond in such a way. The only thing that's really holding us back, therefore, it's not international pressure and it's not this or that threat or what have you. It's none of those things. It's it's our own inability to get our minds around this concept that when you're in war, your aim and your the imperative that must drive all your actions is to destroy the enemy. Destroy the enemy. That's generally, the best policy. Destroy the enemy, because then they can't come at you a second time. Why give him a second chance? If he came at you once, destroy him, that's the end of it. But even if you can't do that for different reasons, you can certainly send a message that's so painful for the other side that they'll stop. And that's exactly what I said before. Missile barrages, artillery, aerial bombardment, they couldn't deal with that for more than a day or two. Sorry?
Hiroshima.
Yes, exactly. Right. Hiroshima is a very good concept. Exactly. The same is true of Iran, but we can discuss Iran. Iran is a different issue, but there are different things to take into account. But a similar message has to be sent to the Iranians as well. Now, how does this connect? How does any of this connect to what we were discussing the last couple of shiurim? I have here on my computer an article written by a gentleman who lives about 150 meters in that direction, whose name is Harav Professor Neria Gutel. I know who he is personally, and I can tell you at the outset that he is an exceptionally learned and an exceptionally intelligent individual. Alright? He's not my friend, and I'm not always generous with words of praise, but I tell you, at the outset, this gentleman is extremely knowledgeable. He's a big Tamid Chachamim, and he's very, very intelligent, all right? He wrote an article, which appeared some years ago, I don't remember exactly how many years ago, in a Torah journal called Tichumin. I think it's volume 18, if I'm not mistaken. The name of the article in Hebrew is Lachima b'shetach revui uchlusiyah ezrahith, fighting or warfare in an urban built-up area. In other words, an area in which you have a large civilian population. What are the halachic parameters? How are we supposed to deal with this issue? Now, I can't give you the whole article, everything he says, because it's how many pages long? It's 30 pages long, the way I have it printed up here. And it's full of footnotes, and it's very learned, and it's very interesting. But I can't give you the bottom line. He begins by saying, I'll read the one sentence he gives here. He says at the beginning here, "Alfei shenoth galuf mi adama eretz medina hevi ledildul mekorot hilchatiim haoskim yeshirot binyanim ele." The fact that Jewish people were removed from their own land and did not exist as a sovereign nation for so long has led to the state of affairs, says Rav Gutel, that the halachic sources on these kinds of issues are very few and far between. In other words, you won't find this mentioned in the Mishnah Brura. Right? Look at the Mishnah Brura, look at the Hafetz Chaim. He doesn't tell you what you do, and how exactly you go about fighting the Hezbollah in Lebanon. He doesn't tell you. Malasot, it's just not written there, because it's not something that the Jews in Russia tended to do. In addition, says Rav Gutel in this article, he says that it's impossible for us to use as a basis for halachic decision-making on such an issue, which is, of course, something which involves dinei nefeshot in all senses of the word. In other words, it involves dinei nefeshot of our own soldiers, for example. In other words, if you send them in to fight in a grand offensive in Azar and Lebanon, you're going to lose soldiers, because that's what happens, no matter how good the army is. So it's dinei nefeshot of Jews and soldiers. It's also dinei nefeshot on the other side. In other words, if you adopt the approach that I suggested a moment ago, which is rain thousands of missiles and shells on them until they get the message, well, there's a lot of dead people that are going to be lying all over the places in little pieces in Azar before the penny drops, before they get the message. So it's dinei nefeshot, okay? So maybe it's not our people, but they are human beings, so let's also consider it. So dinei nefeshot either way, nachon? True, it is. He says we cannot use the Tanakh, any pasuk or any sugya, any parasha in the Tanakh cannot be used as a source in such a halachic debate. In other words, we are not able to learn anything from the Tanakh when it comes to this issue. I also should mention, I should mention that I'm not only basing what I'm saying now and when I'm presenting to you what this rabbi says on the subject, based on the article I have here in front of me. About 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, I heard him speak on this very issue, and I was present throughout the entire speech and talk that he gave, and I heard him explain his position directly with my own ears. So what I'm telling you is exactly what he said. He indicates in what he says here that until the Sanhedrin is re-established, etc., etc., then we cannot use psukim from the Tanakh as any kind of a basis for any kind of halachic psak halacha, any halachic position. Furthermore, he says something else, and this is really where it ties into our previous discussion. He says that we are only able to be posek halacha today on issues where we have what he calls a masoreth shel pesika, a tradition of psika, of psak halacha. For example, ilchot shabbat, ilchot nida, ilchot kashrut, ilchot tzitzit. These are things that Jews have always been doing, correct? Whether they're in galuth or not in the galuth. Ilchot melachim or milhamot, ilchot sanhedrin, ilchot Beth HaBechira, things to do with the Beth Mikdash, or what have you, all kinds of other issues the Jewish people haven't been dealing with for a very long time, and therefore we're sort of rusty, so to speak, when it comes to these things. We need to get ourselves back into shape, as it were, right? We have to train. But the other things that we've been doing all along, we know about, and we have a Masorah Shel Psika. In other words, we have books written by Posekim over the centuries, over the generations, a kind of chain of posekim who've dealt with these issues, who've spoken about these issues, and you can see how the different posekim in different times and different places have dealt with these different halachot. And only on that basis are we able today to give any kind of psak halacha. So if a question in kashrut, for example, arises, according to this understanding of halacha that this person is presenting, and again, I stress, he is extremely learned and extremely intelligent. He's not lacking either of those two elements that a real Talmid Chacham requires. He says that only when you have a Masorah Shel Pesika are you able to give a Psak Halacha. On something where there is no Masorah Shel Pesika, such as what does the Halacha say about how you fight your enemy when you have all kinds of civilians in the area as well, we haven't got a Masorah Shel Pesika on this issue. This doesn't appear in the Shulchan Aruch, and it doesn't appear in the Tur, it doesn't. It does in a way appear, I think, in the Rambam, but and I quoted one source to you from the Rambam where I think which is relevant, but or somewhat relevant, but it's not. The Rambam doesn't go into all the details of anything. The Rambam is very brief and concise and can't cover every detail. That's a general rule of thumb. It's a fact of life. One cannot write a book that covers every possible circumstance. No country on earth has on the statute books has a law that covers every possible situation. You have general rules of thumb, general principles, and from that you have to extrapolate and judge every particular case on its merits. Therefore, says Rav Gutel, seeing that, and I'm mentioning his name, by the way, because he wrote this article and he published it. There's no inyan of Lashon Hara here. I just want to make this very clear. First of all, I don't think there's any inyan of Lashon Hara bichlal when you're talking about a halachic issue, when you're expressing, so-and-so expresses one opinion, and so-and-so expresses another opinion. Just like when Rabbeinu Tam says about his grandfather Rashi, he says, Rashi said this, and I think he's wrong. It's not Lashon Hara. He's telling you, I think this is not correct, because we're trying to understand the Torah. We need to understand the Torah. We have to arrive at the truth. And in this case, I think my grandfather, Zitzal Rashi, made a mistake. I think it's not correct. And you have to say what is correct, and not lo tahuru mi panaish, do not fear any man, so says the Torah when it comes to matters of judgment. So here also Rav Gutel published this article many years ago in a journal. Obviously, therefore, it's in the public domain. Everyone knows, anyone who wants to know can know what he thinks. And also I heard him speak about it in front of an audience of, let's say, 50 people. So obviously he's not embarrassed and he's not trying to hide anything. This is what he thinks. And it's precisely because he's so learned and so intelligent that I bring this example, also because of the subject matter. This is a very powerful example for what I'm trying to explain, for what I'm trying to demonstrate. Navneri Gutel's conclusion, therefore, is that we can't use a Tanakh as any kind of a basis. We can't, and he also added, I heard him say this in his talk, in his speech that he gave about this, that similarly you can't bring proof from Rishonim. You can't bring a Rambam or a Rashi or the Ra'avad or the Rashba from somewhere in our literature and say, based on this statement of the Rashba or Rashi, we see that you can learn from this or extrapolate from this that the halakha should be X, Y, Z in this situation. This you cannot do. This is part of his halachic framework, as he understands the halachic framework in which we are supposedly required to function. He says our halachic framework is one where all the Rishonim, etc., went through a process of, so to speak, digestion. In other words, they like a cow ruminates. You know, it goes through several stages of digestion and discussion, and later latter-day posukim look at the statements and the explanations of earlier posukim, and they discuss and they debate, and these later posukim reach some conclusion, and by some rather nebulous method, which is actually very unclear to me, some halachic position is reached, and then we have a halachic position, then we have a masor shel psika, then we have a tradition. This is the halacha in this case. Then you can express an opinion because you're basing yourself on this chain, as it were, of chachamim going back from that time in the past down to the present day, down to where you are right now. But when there's a break in the chain, so to speak. In other words, Rishonim discussed it, but the Achronim didn't discuss it because it wasn't meaningful or necessary discussion. Or it wasn't discussed by all the normally accepted posekim, and therefore there wasn't this process of digestion, of debate, of criticism, etc. Then, even if you bring proof, which is cogent and powerful proof from the Rambam, from Rashi, which seems to suggest that a certain position is the right position to adopt, this cannot be accepted as being a binding halachic position at all, because it didn't go through this system of this chain of command, so to speak. It didn't go through this long generational system and process of debate and criticism and rumination. So you can't use a Tanakh. Apparently, it's just not good enough for us. It's not the right thing to use. We can't use Rishonim. We haven't got a Masorot Shel Psika. And therefore, what do you do? We have this question. It's not as if you can pretend that this question doesn't exist. It's a very real issue. Everyone knows it's real. He himself knows it's very real. And it's the life and death question, literally, in every sense of the word. So what do you do? Well, I can tell you exactly what he said and what he writes here. He said that we are unable, according to the halachic system that as he understands it and as he believes, and I think he's correct. Although what I think he did here, he succeeded in doing here, is to verbalize and give some kind of intellectual framework to this halachic position that most people, most rabbanim, work by, but do not know exactly why they work by it, or they can't really explain the system. He tries to explain the system. He says, seeing that we haven't got this chain of command, we haven't got this Masorot Shel Psika, therefore the Tanakh is not a relevant source, therefore the Rishonim are not a relevant source, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't talk about it, so what do we do? We can't do anything. We can't give a psak halacha on such an issue. No, in other words, this rabbi can express this opinion, he can say that opinion, but these opinions are just opinions, personal leanings, as it were. They don't have carry any halachic weight for the reasons that we just explained. So therefore, what are we required to do? Practically, we have to make a decision. What are we supposed to do? You may not believe this, but this is what he says. He says, we are required, therefore, to act in such cases, in all such situations, in accordance with the accepted international norms and practices. This is not at all funny. It's actually, it's tragic in the extreme. But this is exactly what he says. Here you have a person with an IQ probably of 140, and who I happen to know for a fact is Baki Bashas, And he tells you that the Torah is unable to express an opinion on what the Israeli government, not that the Israeli government's asking, I know that. I'm not suggesting that it's all the Rabbanim's fault, that what about that which is going on is all the fault of Rabbanim. It's not as if any recent government in recent memory asked the Rabbanim, how would you suggest we deal with the Hezbollah? No. But the point is, if they were to ask such a question, and one day one hopes we would have a government that might, you would like to think that there would be Rabbanim who would actually know what to say. Rav Gutel informs us that there are no such Rabbanim, and there can't be such Rabbanim who would know what to say, because by definition there is no halakha, and there cannot be an halakha on this issue. Therefore, the only possible fallback is to conduct ourselves in accordance with internationally accepted norms and practices in such situations. This is very interesting, by the way, because one of those sources or international agreements is the Geneva, well-known, the famous, oft-quoted Geneva Treaty. What's it called? Geneva Accords. I haven't got the exact text in front of me, but all you need to do is go onto your computer and punch in Geneva Accords, and you'll find it all by yourself. You'll discover that in the Geneva Accords it says that if you're in a war situation and you're fighting the enemy, and the enemy has deliberately placed itself amongst the civilian population, that's where it's set itself up, that's where it's hiding, or it's firing at you from within a civilian neighborhood, then you're allowed to fire at the enemy whether there are civilians in the area or not. What you're not supposed to do, according to the Geneva Accords, is deliberately target a civilian area where there is no military activity and they're not really part of the battle, they're not involved in fighting you, they just happen to be there. Which we know, by the way, that all nations did this. The Germans did it to the British did it to the Germans, the Americans did it to the Germans, the Americans did it to the Japanese, although it was actually for a very clear military purpose. It wasn't just revenge. By the way, half the bombing the British did against the Germans, in the Second World War was actually more or less revenge. Or okay. certainly, which I'm not saying is wrong, by the way, I'm just saying that's the fact. The British engaged in a bombing campaign against Germany for something like 4 years. Certainly they deliberately struck many military and industrial targets which helped to cripple the German war effort. But it's also entirely true that they deliberately targeted many, many civilian areas. The most well-known and well-documented case is Dresden, the end of the war, it was no longer relevant. The war was lost anyhow. It wasn't relevant as a military target at all, and the figures are unclear. Some say 160,000, some say 200,000, some say even more. But they killed a lot of Germans in one night, and basically it was just to say, if you did it to us, you can be sure you will do it to you and more. And they did. In the case of the Americans bombing the Japanese at the end of the Second World War, it wasn't just revenge, which is probably also a perfectly reasonable response also, but it was also a military, a legitimate military tactic. The estimate of the American high command was that in order to conquer Japan with a ground offensive, it would cost 1 million American soldiers. So it's a fairly simple calculation. American soldiers or 50,000 Japanese. So they chose 50,000 Japanese, if you ask me. It's a very wise decision. And it did put an end to the war in a matter of days. So it worked. So apparently this is something we can learn from. The fact of the matter is that Rav Gutel tells us that we have to follow international practices and muskamot. He uses the word muskamot, ben numiyot, agreements or not agreements. Muskamot are a consensus, something like a consensus. The fact of the matter is, I don't think there is a consensus. I don't think there is such a thing. I think every country does exactly what it pleases in these situations. I don't think there's any book of rules. I don't think there's any international consensus. And these things are never actually very often debated. When recently, just a couple of weeks ago, American forces in Afghanistan thought, at least, probably were, I wasn't there, but I can't say for sure, but they were under the impression they came under fire from Pakistani troops from across the border. The Americans went and bombed a Pakistani army base in Pakistan, which is a friendly country, supposedly. It's not that friendly, but it's called a friendly nation, and killed 11 Pakistani soldiers. Look, the Pakistanis, of course, were up in arms. If you don't believe me, just read the newspapers from 10 days ago. It's all there. Is that according to some international consensus? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think anyone thought about it for one moment. The Americans tend to shoot at people who shoot at them, and that's a fairly good policy. In fact, they maybe don't shoot enough or use enough firepower, as they didn't do in Vietnam or what have you, but they don't seem to suffer from this intellectual and moral barrier which seems to be preventing us at the present time from responding as we should towards our enemies. So even if you adopt this very strange, and I would say even more than that, not just strange, I would say it's entirely inane position that Rav Gutel is adopting, I'm not sure I know what it means. What international consensus, what agreements, what standards, what practices? When the Americans and the British were fighting in Afghanistan some years ago, and they were trying to rout the Taliban from certain parts of the country, they carpet bombed entire areas of Afghanistan. Hundreds of villages were wiped off the map. No one thought to count exactly who's a civilian and who's not and who has a gun. They just wiped huge areas of the country off the map. That's what they did because that's what they thought they had to do, and I personally have no problem with that. But and maybe some people do, and that's exactly the point. Some people do, but they can't claim, at least I don't believe they can claim, they have a problem with that based on the Torah. They may have a problem with it based on some foreign moral system, some philosophical premises that they may have developed in their own minds. But the Torah does not support such a position. At any rate, to sum up and to emphasize this point, if a very knowledgeable Rav tells us that according to the present halakhic system, which we discussed in the last couple of shirim at length, we are unable to make any kind of halakhic pronouncement, even on such a life and death issue as how we are supposed to fight our enemies, and whether we can attack them with all means at our disposal, use all kinds of weaponry and all kinds of military force against their enemies, or whether we have to go in on tiptoe and try and take into account every Palestinian of every description as we go about the business of trying to defeat our enemies, which is obviously something that can't be done. If such an issue as this cannot be decided by Rabbanim because of the halachic system, the halachic paradigm with which they have been indoctrinated, then I think it's obvious that our position is a very serious one. I think it's obvious that the halachic system has broken down completely. And that's why, even if you were to tomorrow morning create a Sanhedrin based on such Rabbanim, to a large extent you would not have achieved a thing. Because what are such Rabbanim going to do? They're still bound by the halachic system in which they believe, apparently, no? Or how exactly would it work? That if you were to tell them, well, on Wednesday morning at 9 a.m., you're expected to show up at the first session of the newly formed Sanhedrin. This is the address, this is your tag, wear it on your shirt, and we expect to see you there at 9 a.m. sharp. And the first item on the agenda is how to fight the enemy in built-up areas with civilian populations. Well, are they all of a sudden somehow exempt from the halachic system with which they've been working for decades, which was drummed into them? How exactly do they shed this halachic system from themselves and adopt an entirely new mindset and a new halachic approach in order to be able to deal with such an issue in a real and a significant and meaningful way? Or is it more likely that they would get together and discuss it and say and reach the conclusion that Rav Gutel has already reached for us, that really we can't say anything at all? So we'll just tell the Prime Minister that we don't know, and he should look up the whatever international consensus or rules may apply, and wish him the best of luck. That is not a Sanhedrin, and that's that kind of Sanhedrin, to be perfectly frank, we're much better off without. And that's exactly why any discussion of forming a Sanhedrin, or any kind of body, even if you don't use the word Sanhedrin, I don't care what word you do use, any kind of serious Beth Din for the Jewish people to decide serious issues that the Jewish people needs to have discussed by Talmidei Chachamim, any such body, if it's not based on a different set of premises, halachic premises, a different kind of paradigm, different approach to studying Torah and understanding Torah and reaching opinions and halachic conclusions, if that is not part of the process, then I'm afraid the whole thing is a bracha levatala. And this, I imagine, is food for thought for all of us. There are people who talk about the Sanhedrin, but they're not talking about this. And without this, the rest is not going to happen. And even if it happens, it's not going to be have any meaning. It's not going to be any great improvement in our situation. Also, I wish to point out, for the record, that this individual, Rav Gutel, is not, it goes without saying, not, he's not a reform rabbi, he's not a conservative rabbi. He's not a modern Orthodox rabbi from Atlanta, Georgia, who really doesn't know about Ilchot Melachim Milhamot. He's not a Memad rabbi here in Israel, some, you know, sort of left-wing, modern Orthodox left-wing type with liberal leanings. He's not that kind of person at all. He happens to be right-wing. You see, if it was Rabbi X, Y, or Z, I won't mention names, it doesn't matter, who are known to have leftist leanings and liberal positions on different issues, even though they are Talmidei Chachamim of a serious caliber, then it would be less surprising that such a person would adopt such a position. But when a Rav, who's very knowledgeable, and he's not left-wing, he's not centrist, he's right-wing, he's someone that you know for a fact opposed the destruction of Gush Katif, for example. I do know for a fact. On a good day, if I have my arm doesn't hurt me, it's not stiff, I can throw a cricket ball or a tennis ball from my Mirpeset into his house. That's how close we live. We live across the street from each other, more or less. I know this person. I know what he thinks. I know what he's like. He's not saying this because he has an agenda. He hasn't got an agenda. He is being intellectually honest from his position. From his point of view, he's being entirely honest. In fact, much more honest than I think I've ever seen anyone else who thinks in this fashion ever be. He has stated for us here in this article and the talk that I heard the truth about this halachic system, and that is, unfortunately, this halachic system is bankrupt. And that's something that I imagine we all need to internalize and ponder. Whether the Jewish people can ever possibly get their act together based on such an halachic system. And with those thoughts, I wish you a good evening. Are there any questions?
What would the good Rav have to say about people who advocate a secession of certain parts of Israel and calling themselves Medinat Yehuda?
It's a non-starter as far as I can see. Certainly in the present situation, for the simple reason that the vast majority of Jews in Yudan Shomron are not interested in such an option. In other words, if that's their only choice to adopt that position or try and make such a thing work or leave, they'll leave. In other words, you can't succeed with such a program, even if you happen to be very with it and savvy and you have a well thought out plan. If you haven't got people who want to do it, you first have to get a lot of people who want such a thing to happen. In the same way that, for example, the Zionist movement did not involve the entire Jewish people, but there was a large critical mass of Jews in Eretz Israel who were behind that program and were determined to make it work. If the Zionist movement had only 500 supporters in Eretz Israel in 1920, then there would not be a state of Israel today. You understand? And that's exactly the situation. Of all the people in Yudan Sharon today, you'd be hard-pressed to find 500 who go along with such an idea.
I have a hard time understanding, even though I understand the whole idea of this halachic system that this Rav feels contained by, I don't understand why he would say you need a Masorah Psika, because it seems like you couldn't apply yourself, apply halacha to any new situation. For example, and I don't understand, because even certain poskim, like for example Moshe Feinstein, who in many cases when dealing with fertility issues and certain things like that, bases himself on a stray midrash. I mean, that's not a Masira Shel Psika of, you know, generation to generation discussing this. He actually based himself on literally one midrash. So I don't understand why this Rav feels that unless you have this Masira Shel Psika, you can't apply the Torah and the Halacha into a new situation.
I think the answer to what you're asking is the subject matter. What kind of issues was Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal discussing? And by the way, you mentioned Rav Moshe Feinstein, which is very significant that you mentioned Dafke him. I mentioned last week the Chazon Ish. Mm-hmm. In the last few generations, the most courageous and authentic, I think, and original posukim, I think, were the Chazon Ish and Rav Moshe Feinstein, much more so than others. But even so, having said that, what was Rav Moshe Feinstein discussing in those issues that you're looking at? You're talking, nevertheless, about things that fall within the purview of what we can call Hazman Hazeh, right? In other words, the things that the Jewish people do in a Mitziut of Galut. So there, I think he would feel compelled to give some response to some practical day-to-day issue which falls within the framework of, you know, Arba Chalkei Shulchan Aruch. But if you're talking about Hilchot Melachim U'Milchamot, which doesn't appear in that literature, as we said before, I think you would find that there too, Rav Moshe Feinstein would be, perhaps at least, would have been less forthcoming. All right. I wish you all kol tov.